Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.
And here is David Coleman. It really is an awfully tough one to try and parent your way through properly, because the last thing the children need is your TED talk on 60, 70 years of Middle East conflict. How do you deal with it?
I suppose it's really about trying to explore, probably start with, you know, what do they already know? What are they aware of? Because I think we have to, I suppose, be conscious now that the kind of information children can be exposed to, even if we've been somewhat careful in terms of what we think we're letting them see or hear, you know, with the internet now and kids' access to the internet, chances are they've got a lot more information already. So start with what do they know? And then check in, you know, with them about, like, and how are they feeling about that? What are they understanding? What sense are they already making of it? So this is assuming that they're, you know, kind of 7, 8 up. You know, if they're younger, you're probably not going to get an awful lot of, you know, insight necessarily from them. But I think it's, yeah, just trying to explore what do they know and then trying to contextualize it for yourself, you know. So obviously you've got your value base, your value system, your understanding of what this is about and your perspective on the rights and the wrongs. And then, you just put it into that context.
We are in very, very new territory here, though, because when we were growing up, our exposure to these conflicts was filtered by news editors who made very conscious decisions not to share the images that we are seeing now and that they are probably going to be more exposed to being so terminally online in a way that just wasn't true of previous generations.
Yeah, and I think that's the same, you know, whether it's to do with the war in Gaza, whatever it might be in terms of world tragedies or major conflicts, it's all about, I suppose, trying to understand what do they already know, because, you know, then we can give some kind of context or then we can offer some kind of reassurance or some kind of understanding just to help them make sense of it. Because, you know, children will, you know, for lots of different reasons, be exposed to suffering and hardship and difficulty. And that's not necessarily bad for them. It's just, though, about how do they make sense of it? And so that's the bit that, as a parent, that's your job, really, is to try to help them make as much sense of it as they can. Such as, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of parents probably won't be able to make it much sense of what's happening.
No, absolutely not. But your starting point, as is so often your starting point with whatever issue it is talk to them, ask them questions rather than mansplain your way through the Middle East conflict. Find out what they know and what they're worried about.
Yeah, and I think the key, though, is that if they come to you with a question, you know, always do your best to try to give as much information as you can, again, to help them just make sense of whatever it is that they're questioning about. And you know, that would be the same of a, you know, conflict or a war, or whether it's, you know, kind of some question about sex or whatever it might be. It's just, if your child has a curiosity about it, that means they have some kind of knowledge already that they just want to get some kind of clarity. And that is your job, because then, as I say, you can put it into your context with your values, your beliefs and your understanding. And that then helps them. That gives them just a solid base from which they can then try to continue to make sense of whatever they're hearing.
We're still in July, but there are some people who are thinking about getting back to school. Our first listener question comes from somebody whose son is leaving sixth class in the secondary school. He was offered nobody from his national school is going to, and he is very, very upset about this. How do I help him prepare for September and going in knowing nobody and the anxiety that it's already causing him?
Yeah, and so that would be potentially a very big deal. I suppose a lot depends on his capacity for, you know, making new friends. So if he's generally sociable and quite a social character, it probably is just that gunk of feeling like, oh, nobody else from my school is going here. And that's more common, I think, than we, you know, we might think at the moment, particularly because there's an awful lot of schools, so there's a lot of competition to get into them. And, you know, there's lots of people applying and you don't often get your first choice if you have a a choice of secondary school. I think when, you know, you're in a situation where obviously the secondary school is just the only secondary school and pretty much everybody from the primary school is going to the secondary school, you know, that can be good, but it can also be bad because then maybe you're going with people where you already have issues with them as well. So so in some ways, he's lucky. He's going to get a very fresh start, a very clean start. So that might be something to talk with him about. But I think,
chance
again,
to reinvent yourself.
Well, even
at
just
10.
At 12 or 13, 12, yeah. Presumably, if he's going into secondary school. So so I think it's about, again, trying to explore with him what is it that's really upsetting? Is it the fact that he's going to know nobody? Is it the fact that this is going to be this brand new big place that he's just very unsure about? Anyway, I mean, the transition to secondary school, even when you know that there are going to be people there that you like and get on with, can still be challenging for children. So I think it's about seeing, can they, you know, have any chance to maybe visit the school? Could they reach out to somebody on the pastoral care team? Is there some way maybe to find out, you know, what might be the best routes to some of the social connections? Is it through sports? Is it through other clubs or societies that the school might have that he could maybe get, you know, involved in? Because that, again, usually provides the most natural context for children to make friends, you know, when they have this shared interest in whatever it is. So that might be the way to do it. Just explore with him, you know, what is the key worries that he has? The more you understand about what is the big challenge for him, the more you might be then able to offer him suggestions in terms of how he can then cope with that. There is always the danger, though, and I think I end up saying this regularly enough, that, you know, unasked for advice is almost always unwelcome. So just because it's a challenge, just because he's upset about it, doesn't necessarily mean he wants you to fix it either. So I always think as a parent, you have to be just that little bit careful. Do try and understand what the issue is. Do check, would he like some help with it? And if there's some help that you can offer and he wants it, brilliant. Go ahead, offer the help, you know, and that might be about making some of those introductions.
But don't be afraid to say, you're clever, you've got this.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you start freaking out about it too, that'll definitely make it harder for him. I think if you show him that you have great confidence and great belief in him and that you've seen him, maybe you have stories of other situations he's gone into, maybe he's been to a summer camp already where he knew nobody, coped very well, that would be good learning for him, just to be reminded of that, to be able to reflect on that a bit.
Now, it's 11:45. People should be well over digesting their breakfast, and I'm afraid they're going to have to be for our next one, because it comes from the parent of a four-year-old boy who refuses to make a poo in the toilet. He is toilet trained, but is still pooing in his nappy. He goes into a quiet place in the house to do this. Have tried to coax him, but he still won't use the toilet and has to be reminded that he needs to go and do a number two. Sometimes he holds on and his tummy gets hard. Oh, Lord. Any advice?
So I guess there's a number of things. I mean, if he's toilet trained in terms of weeing, that's good. So he's used to not having a nappy on. I mean, it's interesting then that if he's not generally wearing a nappy because he's going to the toilet to do his wees, he must ask for a nappy when he wants to do a poo. So that's something. So that means that he's getting the signals that he needs to do a poo. So the fact that there are times when his stomach gets hard, that would suggest that maybe he's holding on, that he doesn't even want to. He's a bit embarrassed to ask for the nappy, perhaps. So it might be about exploring with him, you know, when he asks for the nappy or has the nappy on, you know, he could also then perhaps sit on a potty, even if he's doing the poo in the nappy. So that it's almost like a little bridge between using the potty or whatever it might be and actually doing the poo. And then I think it's about trying to maybe minimize the pressure on him. I think if he feels that there's this massive pressure there, that his parents need him to be doing his poos in the toilet, that anxiety or the stress that creates, and that might be part of why he's holding on, could also then actually get in the way. So maybe reduce the pressure, just accept this is something that's going to happen. Get him used to the idea of sitting on the toilet with no nappy on or the potty, whichever they're using.
Could also be something mechanical and being afraid to sit on that toilet and not... The use of one of those inserts that makes the opening smaller.
Yeah, and I've come across many families over the years where, you know, a child has started using the toilet or a potty to do a poo, and then they've just had a particularly painful poo for whatever reason, again, just because it was large and so on.
So in their mind, it becomes the toilet's fault.
And the toilet's fault, exactly. So all of those things, I think if you can get them back used to sitting on the toilet, even if he and have no expectation that he's going to do a poo, just but just reinforce that by maybe sitting with him. You could maybe do a little bit of story time with him while he's sitting on the toilet, and that he gets in the regular habit of sitting on the toilet two or three times a day, maybe after meals, because that's the most common time when our digestive system gets activated and so on. And so that might be the way then, just to get him used to the habit of it. And then, you know, if he ever has a successful bowel motion in the toilet, well, that's going to be, you know, all the like, oh, that's fantastic. Isn't that great to see? And that wasn't so bad. And all those things that maybe you were afraid of. And I'm delighted now that that's happened. And, you know, you don't have to necessarily reinforce with any gift or treat or anything, but it's just, I think, the acknowledgement that this is a good thing and it's part of your growing up and so on. But yeah, maybe a little bridge, allow him to, you know, use a potty, but still have the nappy on. That might be the bridge to getting used to sitting on a potty or sitting on the toilet, if they have the insert on the toilet. And then maybe just getting him, back sitting on the toilet.
And the good news is 20 years down the line, you'll all get to talk about the time we had to stand in a circle and applaud you for going the toilet. Okay, here is one that could come from any one of thousands of households around the country. My 14-year-old is spending her summer holidays in her room on her phone. We normally get her to hand up the phone at 10:30 on school nights, but it's a battle now during the holidays. We agreed 1 a.m., but it's normally 2 a.m. She says her friends get the phone all night. She's spending 15 hours a day on her phone. We ask her to do chores, but it's a battle. We are up early for work, so it's very frustrating and tiring trying to get her to give us the phone. She asks her friends to meet up, but they all seem to be busy, and it might only happen once or twice a week.
Yeah, I think you're dead right. That is a challenge, I think, in thousands and thousands of homes around the country. And it's an increasing challenge. I think, you know, there are more families where this is becoming a challenge, and the challenge is becoming even more, I don't know, conflictual in lots of families. There's a lot to be said for, it's not much solace to this particular family, but starting early in terms of the rules and the boundaries that you set whenever your child is about to get their first phone. And so one of the things I would strongly recommend is never let your child have their phone in their bedroom unsupervised. Certainly not at the start, because that means then that there is a natural time when they're going to bed that they have to give up their phone, because it's just not allowed in their bedroom. So that would be an easier transition.
They will always try and negotiate with you on that. Is it all right as a parent to say, I don't care what Johnny or Mary's parents let them do, this is what's happening in this house? Or is there a better way around that?
No, the principle is exactly right, that what your family does is what your family does, and what other families do is entirely their business. And just because other families do it doesn't mean that our family is going to do it. The phrase, I don't care, whenever we use that, we just have to be a little bit wary of it, because what that suggests to your child is that you're just not even listening to them. And so it is worth it for this particular family with their 14-year-old sitting down again and really trying to understand what is the importance of phone. So 14 is one of the trickiest ages of our teenage years. It's the time when belonging and not being different and being connected is critically important for most teenagers. And so that means then that for her, you know, the need to be on her phone is possibly an entertainment, but probably as much, if not more, about the social connection.
But the problem there comes, David, that trying to break that immediate cycle, that you remove the screen, whatever form of screen it is, and you're dealing with a very cranky and irritable child who is going to be very hard to get through to and have that conversation with.
Yeah, and so it is about picking the moment, obviously. But I think as a parent, whenever we have clear evidence, for want of a better word, that things have gone wrong or that there is an issue there, that's a good starting point. And so it might be about sitting down someday, you know, when there hasn't been much fighting about the phone, and saying, look, what we've noticed is you're sleeping, and you're sleeping way later. You're sleeping now till lunchtime, and that's a really bad habit for you. You know, school is only around the corner. Unfortunately, it's 3 weeks away for most, or 3.5 weeks away. And so, you know, you have to be in a better habit for that. We notice that you're fighting with us a lot more. We notice that you seem in really bad form. We notice that you haven't been out walking or done any kind of exercise. We notice that there's no balance with whatever it might be that you used to do that you now no longer seem to do, because, for example, last last Tuesday, we were able to track that you spent 15 hours on your phone. That's not healthy for you. And so I think when we start with that kind of basic premise that this is what we're observing, so this is not just us, you know, on some kind of a mad power kick as parents, like, we just don't want you to have your phone because we don't like you. You know, this is very clear. This is what is caused. These are the problems that, are being caused in our family.
Do you think that anybody doing the one thing, whatever it is, for 15 hours a day is a good idea?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's the conversation you then become. And so it becomes about balance. And so then it might be, you know, down to renegotiating all of the rules about phone use. And it might be about, look, you know, if you want to spend an hour on your phone, then we have to have evidence that you're spending an hour doing something different that actually is allowing your brain to operate in a different way. So it is difficult. It is challenging. And I think, you know, if both parents are working as well, then they're probably feeling really, you know, kind of time poor themselves. And as they said, exhausted. Because if they're worried about their daughter at 1 o'clock in the morning and they're not able to sleep themselves because they're still trying to get this phone, you know, it is a big issue. So maybe one of the weekends, see if you can try to do a bit of a reset with her.
Let me move on to another one that has come in on WhatsApp. My eldest is flying the nest currently, just finished post-primary, and I would have thought I had another 4 years or so to mentally prepare to let them go. Instead, they've gone the apprenticeship route and has already started to work, bought their first car, etc. We've had some very big diagnoses in the family in recent years with life-limiting diagnoses, so already there's a big mental load there. I'm threading a very fine line at the moment with them enjoying the freedom of a car in the countryside and staying out until 3 and 4 a.m. at weekends. I no longer know who they are and who they're with. I keep worries about their safety to myself, and they remind me that they wanted to move out at the start of the summer, but we managed to persuade them to remain at home for now. They are a young 18. I'm finding the house extremely quiet, with their younger sibling also growing into adulthood at 16 and also away a lot. How do I reassure myself I've reared them as well as I could?
Goodness. You know, that, again, I think is going to be just echoing with so many different families who've gone through that process of, you know, approaching the empty nest. And it is a big deal. And I think, you know, different parents are going to respond to it in different ways. I mean, most of my kids, well, all of my kids are grown up now and they've all left home. And I certainly had a period where I was like, this is fantastic. You come down and the kitchen is exactly how you left it. You know, there's no extra pots and pans and frying pans. And
but
you know,
then that's
still
replaced over time by the little ache in the chest.
Yeah. And so, you know, and so we definitely miss them. And I think it's about that process. You know, in some ways, it's an element of grieving, or it's a very similar process to grieving, because it's about loss. It's about loss of the family life that you had. It's about loss of the connection that you might have had with your son or daughter. So in this case, I think if that's a mom or a dad, it doesn't really matter. But, you know, what they're noticing is that their son is just no longer available in the way that they used to be. And that they're, you know, they said, you know, at the start, like, I expected I'd have 3 or 4 more years of, you know, that kind of ability to be a mam or to be a dad.
And that growing realization as well that perhaps, as is the case for so many parent-child relationships, that you love them more than they're going to ever love you.
It's not about the love, but I think, you know, you might need them more than they need you now. And so, you know, you might need, in terms of, you know, what is important for you in your role, perhaps as a carer, you know, that for many parents, probably more so for mams, maybe, you know, that role of being a primary carer is so significant. And the loss of it, the adjustment to no longer needing to be that person can be very hard.
But all of those fears about the what ifs and fears about road accidents and what's going to happen to them about being out until 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. Is there anything to do there other than just let go and trust that you have done the job of raising them responsibly or to be responsible properly?
Yeah, but also you have to mind yourself a little bit. And so one of the key things there, I would say, is social support. So hopefully your husband or wife, depending on who it is that was contacting you, is also tuned in. And that can, as I say, can sometimes be a bit difficult. I know, you know, my wife won't mind me saying she was in a very different place when our last child left home than I was. As I say, I was practically celebrating the freedom that I perceived we would have.
There's your headline, newspaper writer David Goldman celebrates departure of child.
Well, you know, I do think it's important. Like, it is interesting as well. You know, I don't know how much time we have, but
30
you know,
seconds.
Great. Well, just, you know, for that man to say that, you know, that the son said, you know, I wanted to move out and you persuaded me to stay on. And so that was that's interesting, isn't it? That he felt ready to go, even though they felt he was a young 18.
And that there's still lines of communication open.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think things will balance out. But like, talk to a lot of your friends, particularly other friends who are going through the same thing. Talk to extended family. You know, there will be other people who've gone through this who can reassure you that it will all be okay in the end. But I think it is hard. It's just about that transition, the adjustment.
Indeed. David Coleman, thank you very much, as always. Let's take a break.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.